Welcome to the Ortho Joe Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Morning, Mo. Well, we're recording fairly early, CS Central Standard Time.
Yes, yes, it is early, and I apologize for switching the timelines this morning, but we have no shortage of interesting topics to talk about. And in my rush to make this earlier than normal, I forgot my coffee. I'm going to be getting it post Ortho Joe.
Well, I know you're heading to Tim Hortons. We don't have Tim Hortons in the Twin Cities, so
I know.
I've had to make a latte. I'm at home recording from home, so I don't have access to my highly valued Ortho Joe mug. So I've got an old American Board of Orthopedic Surgery.
Oh, very good though. The branding
with a latte and some cocoa on top. So
love that. Love that. Well, listen, why don't we jump in? Today's topic of interest for me anyways, and I know it is for you, is this issue of just ankle fractures. And there was an interesting paper that is out in this past issue of the JBJS. And for those who are listening in, it was entitled Complications After Ankle Fracture Surgery in Finland between 1998 and 2020. This is a large study, large Finnish study that covers about just under 84,000 patients with ankle fractures in the database, of which over half, when looked at all fractures, were bimalleolar, so the fractures. And basically what they found, to paraphrase, and I encourage those who are listening in or watching to take a read of this paper, overall complication rate of about 7.2%, and this is within that, they're calling it early complications, so under, the 12-week complication rate as described as early, of which 4.4% is infection. So infection was one big one. And the other one was reoperations due to, whether it's patients of age greater than 75 or chronic issues like diabetes, were all these factors that were variables associated with this outcome, which was complication rate. The other thing is, though, so that's the short term, right? So the long-term complications, as you can imagine, with ORIF, for the majority of these fractures, was implant removal. So complication itself was, either pain or some functional issue associated with implants requiring a removal. And within a three-year period, they had a 17% implant removal rate. Now, they didn't get into the details about what specific implants were removed, but that was the overriding impact. And obviously, these large database studies, have numerous in general, can have numerous potential challenges, but they also give you some idea, I always think, of complications that might be more uncommon and give you a sense of in practice, what is the expected prognosis following these types of injuries. And I wonder, Mark, with your vast experience, when you think about ankle fractures and outcomes and treatments overall, how does this data impact you at all? Or more importantly, what's your experience taught you?
Yeah, well, I think the infection risk at 7% is one that is the most important catching my eye, certainly. And again, talking about level 5 evidence, in my personal experience, I learned mid-career when we were converting to all outpatient treatment of ankle fractures, basically, except for those that had huge comorbidities, et cetera, that the fracture boots were a problem for wounds. And I think it has to do with the pressure on the incision and shear forces across an incision. So I don't know, 15 years ago, I changed my practice away from discharging patients in those fracture boots. And I have no idea what they do in Finland, whether that could be even contributing to this issue. But I've gone to a standard plaster-based splint for the first week until the incision is pretty solidly healed, then into a boot with weight-bearing as tolerated. And hopefully we can talk about weight-bearing as tolerated too, but that's not really a topic of this manuscript at all. But so that's one thing that I have learned in my experience is avoid the boots. The second thing I would make a comment on is particularly with diabetics, and I make this teaching point very frequently with my residents, is really you should not do standard types of dissection where you're going layer by layer. With diabetics, it's most important to have very thick flaps and not undermine the skin at the subcutaneous level, which puts at jeopardy the vessels coming from the investing fascia. And so those are the two points that I would make about infection that come from my practice experience.
And you know, I mean, like when you think of, you know, if you think about all, if you think about all fractures treated, you think there would also be a pretty substantial debate on should you even operate, right? I mean, if you look at over half of them being bimalleolar, we would assume that the unstable bimalleolar are going to require some sort of procedure. But you know that there's been a ton of research now exploring, you know, when we need to operate, when we don't. Probably, I would think, and I'll throw some of these, you know, papers out that at least come to mind that I have a brief recollection of. But there was the JAMA paper that came out, a randomized trial in 2017 that looked specifically at, you know, should we be doing close contact casting, which I guess gets to your point. If it's a diabetic patient, you definitely want to have a good, you know, complete cast, if it was that, you know, if we were going to consider an operative treatment in that patient population versus, you know, standard open reduction, internal fixation. And at 6 months, they found really no difference in functional outcome. Now, they did say that the patients who were treated with casts at that time were more likely to have a malunion or require some secondary procedure, you know, because of the fracture displacement. And as you can imagine, the infection rates that we're seeing overall in this Finnish large database study are pretty well, for the most part, significantly reduced with non-operative treatment. When you think about, you know, these sorts of operative versus non-operative, you know, is there, I mean, there's clearly a reason, there's clearly lots of reasons to be operating. But do you think that the pendulum will swing more towards a non-operative treatment in open in these ankle fractures, especially the bimalleolar types? Because I think there's lots of discussion around, you know, sort of the lateral malleolar fractures themselves. But I'm wondering about the bimalleolar.
Right. So if my memory is anywhere close to accurate, that was a older population. I don't remember what the age cutoff was, but seems right. Like it was in the 60s at least.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
When your major outcome is a functional outcome, you know, this population of patients has really low functional demands. So they're not active individuals who are out playing pickleball or anything like that. So I think we are going to, as a community, are going to get smarter about operating on low functional demand patients and considering non-surgical care for those. And it also, if memory serves on that paper, it was standard operative management. And I think for the elderly population, we're going to get better at minimally invasive techniques, like going back to the old intramedullary fixation for the distal fibula with a very small incision at the tip of the fibula to put up an intramedullary device rather than exposing the patient to the risk of a larger dissection. I think one of the more modern debates is whether or not in a bimalleolar, do you need to fix the medial malleolus? And of course, we know radiographically, you're going to get a fair number of non-unions. And does a fibrous non-union really require fixation? Often it doesn't. So that's the more active debate, I think, in younger patients.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, when it comes back to, you know, okay, so you put it in, like, you know, like you put in some sort of implant. And then this idea that they're talking about the longer term sequelae, you know, again, you're prognostically talking to patients here around, well, there's a, you know, 1 in 5 chance, and this is 17%, so not quite that, but you know, 1 in 5 chance that we're going to have to take out the implant, usually due to irritation or discomfort, and, you know, occasionally due to infection as well, right? Infection rates aren't negligible in this long term. But I'll go back, and I remember as a resident hearing Doug Derschel and Bill Obremski at the Orthopedic Trauma Association, I believe that paper was published sometime in almost 20 years ago, where they looked at well over 120 some odd patients who had been treated with open reduction total fixation and who had had, you know, symptoms and symptomatology to have their implants removed for pain. And they found, and I remember this clearly, half the patients had no impact on their reduction in pain after implant removal. And that led to this discussion around, well, should you reduce, you know, should you take out the implant because you may not necessarily see a reduction in pain, or they were unsure about that. Now, I happen to find a paper that you were involved with, probably 2018, with Dr. Williams. I think this came out of Minneapolis, but in Foot and Ankle International, which was about 43 patients who had had implant removal. And you looked at, well, their function before and then their function after implant removal. So while pain may be a little more unpredictable, it seemed to be pretty clear that there was a pretty dramatic improvement in function in patients who had had their implants removed. So I guess the broad question is, should we be removing implants more? Should we not be? Is it about expected to be 1 in 5? And by the way, there's a study from a Norway group that came out not that long ago that also just under 1,000 patients had exactly the same implant removal rate, which was 17%. And again, majority due to pain and irritation. And they also said smoking and infections were also predictors of why implants would come out. So very similar to that very large 84,000 patient overall database study. So there seems to be this 1 in 5 that appears to be the number. And I'm just wondering, it seems to be that's kind of where, if we look at practice, that's where people are. But I'm curious, from your perspective, if when you're discussing plate removal with patients or screw removal, what your discussion is like.
Yeah, when I perform internal fixation of a bimalleolar fracture, I advise the patient that there may be as high as a 50% chance that they have some residual symptoms. It's often uneven ground or pivoting sports in the more active individuals. And I think primarily my hypothesis is it's irritation of the peroneal tendons, which are gliding over the implants when you do plate fixation. And based on that, our experience, this came out of our routine outcomes assessment of all ankle fracture patients long-term at the Trio Orthopedic Center here in Minneapolis. I tell them that there's a 75% chance it's going to help their discomfort with function. And as you saw, it was slightly higher than that. And there are other studies as well that demonstrate a significant pain and functional improvement with implant removal. So it's potentially that is a placebo effect. If some individual is going to have a second operation, they want to believe that it was worthwhile. The only way to tease that out is with a placebo of making an incision and leaving the implant in.
Right.
That would be very hard to get by any institutional review board. But so I advise patients that they may have symptoms, and we may be discussing it 1 year whether or not they'll benefit from an implant removal. And for the most part, it seems to help them.
Yeah, I mean, so when you think about where we need to be going, like you mentioned sort of the discussion around, well, in ankle fractures, there's been a lot of research, tons, but there's still opportunities to do more. Yeah. Where are we still unsure about what we should be doing? And I know an area of interest of ours, both yours and mine, has been, is the future of ankle fracture treatment going to be implant-based, or is it going to be perioperative innovation? Is it going to be a physio or rehab innovation? Where do you think ultimate advances are likely to come? Or have we reached almost a plateau?
I think we're at the point, first of all, on the rehab side, I think there, we've seen numerous trials that early weight-bearing is superior to immobilization and non-weight-bearing for longer periods of time. So that part, there's been a great advance of allowing patients to bear weight as tolerated, assuming they have adequate bone quality and are reasonably compliant and don't have psychological issues, et cetera. So the rehab part, I think we can make some improvements in how aggressive to be, but we know that early weight bearing is helpful. I think implant-based, and there's some suggestion that intramedullary implants that are locking may provide a lower risk of implant removal. We could imagine a trial where we would compare that, let's say in bimalleolar fractures, where a standard plate-based fixation would be compared to that. A large national, international trial, I think, would shed some light on that. And then I think the question of the medial malleolus fixation really needs to be addressed at a very, very large trial. So there's room on the implant side. And there's some more room on different types of rehabilitation strategies, including early weight bearing.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, I do recall coming, and I won't paraphrase this, I don't remember exactly I remember the findings, but I don't remember the specifics of the paper. But it definitely looked at, you know, so one of the issues was, you know, is it possible that, you know, we're getting more irritation with the, you know, sort of the larger, more thicker plates versus, you know, the more low profile plates and, you know, locking versus non-locking. And really there was no difference in need for implant removal. So your points, at least in these small studies, so your points will take in that, you know, if you can get a stable fixation, it, you know, you, that's your goal. And then you don't have to worry about the rest after that. But I agree with you. I don't know. To me, it seems like, you know, when you do like a large database, say like the one we're just talking about, it's very, very helpful to get a big sense of, you know, overall complication rates. But the thing you lose is the ability to collect detailed data. You know, the authors themselves says there's a bunch of data they would have loved to have collected, but unfortunately, just because of the way, you know, they can retrieve information going back in time, you can't really do that. So you almost wonder if, you know, if you, as with anything, you know, you jump to big trials, but you also look for factors that are actually modifiable, prognostic factors that are modifiable that you could deal with. So you could certainly modify perioperative care. You could certainly modify, you know, the surgical approaches. You can modify all those sorts of things. You can modify, you know, any sort of preoperative regimes as well. But you got to find the ones that are actually associated with the outcome measure. And I do think, you know, that it, and there may be, and I apologize if to the investigators who might be doing the big multinational, you know, many, many thousands of patients observational study in ankle fractures. But if that isn't being done, that would certainly be another area to think about where you could collect detailed data as well in concert with randomized clinical trials, I would say.
Right. Well, you've spent your career doing these large trials, and that oftentimes what we learn the most out of are the secondary analyses, which are,
right,
you know, we ask the questions in advance of collecting data, and then the results are so robust, you can't put everything into a single manuscript. And oftentimes you end up with 6-8 secondary analyses that are published. And we at the journal have, as you know, have been publishing these in compendiums, starting with Michelle Geert and the large oncology trial with the use of antibiotics. And so that's the advantage of prospectively carefully collected data. And as you get to observational trials, it becomes harder and harder to get people to comply with the level of detail in an observational trial. And with the resources we have with large randomized trials, we know that the data is of superior quality, and that's the real advantage. But they are incredibly expensive and labor intensive, and we can't do it for everything. You know better than most.
So there you go, Mark. There's a call. There's a call for more ankle fracture research. Boy, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good outcome. But that's anyways,
that's the way we end every manuscript.
I know. Isn't that true? Yeah. But anyways, I think this is good. I think this is a good start. It's a great paper to take a look at for those of you who are interested in ankle fractures. And also, once you start looking at that paper, what always happens is you start looking at the references. You start, you know, looking at other areas, and you get caught up in this great opportunity that is to look and see what's happening in the field of ankle fracture. So again, Mark, lovely chatting with you this morning. Hopefully you avoid the rains where you are. We're getting some pretty serious, you know, torrential downpours. It's really hot and then really, really wet here. Southern Ontario is getting hammered a bit. So hopefully it's a little bit better where you are.
Yeah, it is. We're getting some cooler weather from Alberta. Thank you, Canada. We're going to sing Oh Canada when we get off the line here.
Love it. Have yourself a great day.
Yeah. All right.